That was Amos chapter 3. Now, of course, we're going through these chapters one chapter at a time, but Amos, of course, actually expresses this in an ongoing basis. So chapter 3 and chapter 4 and 2, for that matter, are all jumbled up as one thought process. But we're breaking up into small sections. So recall the details of Amos chapter 1 and chapter 2 that led us up to chapter 3. What's going on in the book of Amos? What's he talking about? Who is he talking to? And why is he addressing these issues? Because they're relevant to us in exploring chapter 3. Yes?
He's bringing to knowledge the sins that are going on around the kingdom of Israel, while at the same time exposing the sins that Israel itself is doing through social injustice.
Right, right. That is the primary function that Amos addresses. And what he has been addressing in chapter 1, 2, and of course 3, he continues on through the book. He is focusing on his attention, everybody's attention, as many as he can get a hold of. Say, hey, pay attention. Bad things have happened to you, and bad things are going to be happening to you because of your iniquities, your evil ways of doing stuff. Now, keep in mind, all of us are aware God is very forgiving. He's very kind. He forgives transgressions, sins, and iniquities. But I want you to think about that. We're not going to address it just yet. But think about in verse 2, it says, he will visit all your iniquities back upon you. Think about what that means while we go through this. Before I go, are there any questions or comments about Amos chapter 3? It's a pretty straightforward chapter. It's just a lot of imagery that he uses and discusses as he tries to expound their understanding. First of all, verse 1. Of course, he says, here this word of the Lord of God against the house of Israel, against the whole family. Now, that means Amos is not just addressing the northern tribes here. He's addressing the northern and southern tribes, the house of Judah as well. That means that in chapter 3 in particular, and of course, he doesn't stop in chapter 3, the 3 in chapter 4, continuing on, they're all, well, most of the 3, but he does just in chapter 4. He's addressing that this is a problem for the whole family. I mean, the problem that's being listed out here in chapter 3 in particular is for the whole family. So Judah's having these issues just as Israel's having these issues. Now, of course, Isaiah expounds tremendously upon this and explains completely all the issues of what's happening to Judah at the same time or shortly thereafter Amos's life or Amos's prophecy. So Isaiah explains that all what Amos is saying is happening in Judah as well, just later. It's just happening still. So he's pointing out to him that in verse 2, you alone have I known the families of the earth. What does that mean? Recall what the Torah says regarding those topics. What does it mean for God to have selected Israel out of all the families of the earth? Yes.
He told them the rules.
Right.
He didn't tell any other nation the rules.
Right. So, in that respect, if you tell your child, here is your set of rules, you explain wholly what these rules are and how to implement them, will you be more upset or frustrated with that child who knows the rules compared to a child over on the other side by somebody else who you did not explain to, that does not know the rules, and they both break them? Which will you be more angry with? The one that knew the rules. The one that you explained very detailed, this is what you must do, this is acceptable behavior, this is not acceptable behavior. You were more frustrated or angry at the one that you explained it to. And this is the key issue with the topic of iniquity. Yeah.
It's nice to talk about rules, but in knowing them, and he basically gave them the opportunity to know him more so than any other nation. And in that knowing him, his hope was that they would love him. So it becomes a lot more intimate than just knowing a set of rules.
Correct. I'm using the example of rules for a child to a parent to a child relationship.
Right.
I'm
not saying there's pain that comes in with that too.
Right. I'm not saying the list that God gave the Torah is strictly a instructional list. I'm not trying to imply that. It is far greater than just that. My point was that when God's looking through his book of list of, for lack of a better term, judgment book of all the things you did right and all the things you did wrong, and discusses them and has you address each one of them, or however he wishes to do it, it's his business. He has a list of his master book, rule book, that he says, this is what you're supposed to do, this is what you did, please explain yourself. That point, when you're talking to your parent, as a parent goes to a child, says, you just struck so-and-so on the head. Explain why you did it. Now, it could just let, oh, hey, I saw you hit them, here's your punishment. No. The child may say, wait a minute, but so-and-so hit me in the stomach. Ah, now that explains your actions. See, so it allows you opportunity, which a parent would do that to the child. Explain what your thoughts, what's going through you, why you did something. And that is that special relationship allows you to do so. And it's very important to have that. And that's part of all of God's lifestyle. We use the term rules, a more accurate way of saying it, way of life, way of existence, way of following, way of being kind and generous and loving to one another, the way that be like God. That's more an accurate description. I shouldn't use that in my analogy with a parent or child, but you get the general idea. Yes, Ellie.
I was the one that said rules. But one of the rules is you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and with all your soul. That's a rule because he said that's what you're supposed to do.
That it is. That is true. It's one of his instructions. So when God selected a particular family and gave them a way of life and existence, a special place in his life or in his relationship with them, he gave them a special place, he designed it for them, he's going to expect or require something for that or with that, just like a parent would expect to require something for or with their child. There's not much difference there. I bring this out to because there is a mentality that's brought up, people bring up all the time, not saying right or wrong, just it is, that a God is a forgiving God. And he is. Immensely forgiving over horrible things he will do. Still very forgiving. Yet, you see, so well, this person did certain things bad. Thus, some bad things should happen to them. But this person over here did things so much worse. But yet, God does nothing to them. And that is a hard thing for a child, us, a person, a human being, to say, well, that's not fair. That's not fair. It's not supposed to be. Because God does not use that measure of fairness. Yes, Sean.
In the first chapter of Romans, he gives a beautiful example. Do you despise the long-suffering and patience of the Lord? Do you not know that leads to repentance?
It does. And this process which God works with, and in this case in chapter 3, he explicitly explains that he's going to visit your iniquities, Israel, the whole family, all tribes, all associates, everybody who threw their hat in the ring, so to speak, everybody who's attached themselves to God's name, he's going to bring all your iniquities back on you. Back on you. Not as opposed to, I'll just throw them out the window and forgive them. No, he explains in Amos and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea, I'm going to visit your iniquities back on you because they were expected to do something different. Do you know the difference between iniquity versus a transgression or sin? Do you recall the differences? Okay, iniquity is likened unto wickedness, for example. Something, whatever it is wrong. I, as a person, I'm going to go do this wrong thing. And I'm going to do it wrong because I love it and God said not to do it. It's a rebellious built into this desire to do evil. That is an iniquitous action. There are individuals or people who choose certain parts of life to do that. That's an iniquity. Now, there's also versus transgression. I'm the same thing, whatever it may be. I know I'm not supposed to do it. I don't want to do it, but I can't seem to stop myself from doing it anyway. I suppose like a flesh of desire, so to speak. That would be classed as a transgression. As opposed to, this other person says, that was wrong? Oh, I had no idea. Or, I didn't even know I did it. That's a sin. There's a difference. It has to do with your comprehension level at the moment which you're going to do something. That's a huge deal, because God cares what's inside your head. Not just what's in your hand, or what your hand does. what you're thinking matters to him as well. Because what you're thinking is inside your heart. Because your heart is where you're supposed to love God. So those are huge parts of how God deals with stuff. So someone who has been explained very thoroughly and agreed wholeheartedly with all that God explained them to do, and they say, well, I know it's wrong. You said it's wrong. I'm going to do it because I want to and because you said it was wrong. It's a rebellious thing. I'm going to do it because you said not to. Ooh, that kind of thing. You know, that it's a rebellious thing. I think bring that up because in chapter 3 and 4, it explains very thoroughly what the leadership of Israel was doing in the book of Amos. It is an iniquitous handling of the people, of a great oppression they were putting upon them, knowing full well the laws were against it, God was against it, even their own religious beliefs, though they were different from God, was against it. They still chose to do it anyway because they really, really wanted to. That was the issue. And God says that in amongst the family that I'm supposed to, that I set aside, is unacceptable. That part of iniquity I'm going to visit back on you. And he's going to explain what that iniquity is going to look like, or how he's going to be visiting it. So Amos moves on from verse 2, into a list of examples. And these examples are comparing Israel, the whole family of Israel, including the southern tribe, and the relationship with God. Each example explains it. So for example, for first instance, verse 3. Will two walk together except they have agreed? Well, who are the two? Israel and God. So if Israel and God are going to walk together, they have to agree, right? Now, if God's moving forward and Israel's moving off to the side, are they still in agreement? Of course not.
The
answer is no. They cannot walk together. These are simple examples any peasant or obvious person who has no education can understand. That's why Amos used them. He's very good at trying to relate complex stuff very simply and basic, because that's who he's trying to talk to. In Amos's mind and his process, he's dealing with the leadership of the house of Israel. But he's treating them as if they're little children, uncomprehending of anything. He does a good job with this explanation. In verse 4, will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? What good would a lion roaring if there's nothing for it to eat? All it's going to do is scare the food that's nearby away. In which case, it goes hungry. So lions are very good at stalking their prey. They're very careful. Cheetahs are exceptionally good at it. Stalk them very, very close. You possibly can get. Don't make a sound until the sound will scare the prey momentarily long enough for it to stop and not run while you're charging. It gives you that extra speed as a lion. They're very good at doing this. Many cats do it, but lions have the roaring ability. It's quite impressive to watch. I'm sure you guys have seen them. It has the prey to do it. If it roars when there's no prey around, what does it accomplish? Nothing. The prey runs away. It doesn't do any good. Of course, a young lion gets forth his roar of a den and have them to eat again. It would scare away any food. So who's the lion and who's the prey? The prey is Israel, the house of Israel. Who's the lion's God? We already know, the lion of God, you've heard that term probably thousands of times. Who's the lion of God? Well, it's Messiah, but the lion is representative of him. So he's the one. And so who's God explaining what's he going to be doing as a lion? He's going to be devouring or attacking his prey. And who's his prey? Israel, the whole house, north and southern tribes. So continue on, verse 5. Will the bird fall into a snare upon the earth when there is no lure for it? Or will a snare spring up from the ground and has taken nothing at all? Who's the snare and who's the bird? Well, yeah, God's the snare, the lure and the snare, and the bird is Israel. He's using the examples of attack. And of course, verse 6, which is more obvious, shall the horn be blown in the city and the people not tremble, or shall evil fall city and the Lord not have done it? So that verse 6 explains verse 5, 4, and 3, that the comparisons of the bad things are from God. So in 5, 4, and 3, the bad things listed are from God. So God is the bad thing, being against the people of Israel. 4 and verse 7, the Lord explains does nothing without reveals his counsel to his servants. What does counsel mean? Anybody ever looked that up? It's a sod. It means a conversational discussion between friends, trying to explain what is good and what is right, what you should do or shouldn't do. It is a counselor, but it's a friendship relationship, and it is a conversational one. So, his point is, the prophets who are explaining God's counseling are fully understanding of what's going on. That's important to know. As opposed to, I don't like to offend anyone, but I'm going to use the term anyway, a snippet dream. When you have a dream, do you comprehend it if it's from God? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. Is it a full comprehension of God's counseling to you? Not even close. It's a vision. It's a dream. You have to explain or have to think about, okay, what does this mean? What's going on? I don't understand. That is not a conversational explanation. Contrast that to Moses and his relationship with God. That is a conversational relationship. They talk back and forth, expound details, and explain misunderstandings. That's a conversational relationship. That is the prophet's job. A genuine prophet. That's a genuine prophet's job, to explain the conversational relationship. There is no ambiguity, no confusion built in. It is fully understood. So God's not going to do anything until his prophets fully understand what's happening. Of course, Amos is trying to explain this because he is one of God's prophets, which they'll later tell him to shut his mouth, but we'll get to that in a minute. So, of course, the lion roared, who will not fear, verse 8. In these examples, in verse 8 in particular, it points out that when you have the lion does roar, he does, obviously, the people will fear it. So, in this conversation that God's explained to the prophets, when the prophets explain the conversation to the people, who will not fear? Well, everyone will fear it. Just like the lion, you would fear the roar of the lion. Everyone will fear it. That's the point. So this explanation, what God's explained to his prophets in the latter half of verse 8, the Lord's spoken. Who cannot explain it? Who cannot process it to tell it? Because you're all going to be afraid. And what's the fear based on? In verse 9, it explains it. It does a great job doing so. In verse 9 and 10, actually. But verse 9, it starts out. To bring Ashdod, which is Philistia, or the Philistines, and Egypt to do something. In this case, they're setting themselves upon the mounts of Samaria to behold great confusion. What great confusion are they beholding? Are they beholding turmoil? Are they beholding a war? Are they beholding... What do you think they're beholding? What already exists in the culture in the city of Samaria that Amos is upset about, that God's upset about, that is obvious to two groups of people who God did not select from the families of the earth? The Philistines and Egypt. Unlike Israel, God selected them from the families of the earth to be a special relationship with him. Egypt and Philistines, God did not. But yet, Egypt and the Philistines will be able to look, could look at Amos's moment in time, could look at Samaria and see, oh, you're all confused. You're messed up. We don't even have the word of God with us. We don't even have his instructions, yet we can recognize you're messed up. That's what Amos is trying to point out to him. It's so obvious, much like all these examples just listed with the bird, the snare, and the lion, the roar, and the prey. It's so obvious, anybody could see it. Behold, the great confusions are in, and the oppressions in the midst thereof. The latter half of verse 9. The oppressions. The oppressions is an important aspect of this, of Amos and Isaiah and Jeremiah. Oppression. God hates oppression. Remember that. All your days, God hates oppression. He says it over and over and over again. That is where it triggers his punishment reaction. When you oppress someone else. That is where he says, enough's enough, I'm not going to use the smite button and smack you senseless for it. Oppression's a big deal. We don't want oppression. And oppression comes usually from the top down, meaning somebody's in charge with somebody else. That's what oppression is. That's where oppression's at. You have to be above them in order to oppress. So in verse 10, it explains what these oppressions do. And what the example of oppression he's focusing on. They don't know to do what is right, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces. Now, we haven't read chapter 4 yet of Amos, but it explains more detail of what the robbery and palaces are. We've also read it in Isaiah chapter 5, where I explained it 2 weeks ago, that Isaiah chapter 5 uses the exact same imagery as Amos does to explain Israel. Isaiah just applies it to Judah specifically. But the same imagery being explained, accumulation of houses, accumulation of property, oppressing others by taking pledge offerings, by collecting it and collecting and keeping it, laying upon these pledge offerings, which the Torah explicitly explains when someone gives you a pledge offering, the clothing on their back, for example, you must return it to them before the end of the day. But in Isaiah, it explains that Judah, as well as Amos, was explaining that Israel would take the pledge offerings and keep them. That is oppression of those who have nothing. So these examples of storing up violence, which is also inclusive of attacking and killing, which, of course, in Amos chapter 1 and 2, and also Isaiah, explains that, in Isaiah 5, explains that the people were selling, the leadership was selling those who were righteous down the road for nothingness in order to acquire their properties, their things. Yes?
Can financial abuse be part of oppression too?
Yes. Financial abuse applies the same way. And the financial abuse, which Amos actually winds up railing against, at least in chapter 6, if I recall correctly, is the instruction from the leadership to tell all the farmers, you have to grow wine. You have to grow grapes. As opposed to your self-sufficient lifestyle. No, we're dictating to you what you must grow. And the reason we're dictating you is because we can acquire more money that way. We can sell it higher tax revenue. And we can actually drink it. You and the farmer, well, I don't really care about you. I'm more interested in acquiring our financial wealth of the country. You're just the source of it. Well, dictating to another man, or woman, make a difference, what they are allowed to do with their own possessions in order to gain for yourself, by penalty of law, well, if you don't do it, we take your land anyway, that's evil. But that is a financial exchange. We're dictating what you're going to be doing in order to, yeah, it's just extortion, in order to get what we want out of it, which is tax revenue and alcohol, because we're really into wine. We don't argue that. In order to gain that out off of you, and you don't have a choice in the matter. You just must do. Else we just take it anyway. That is a form of extortion. It is a financial gain for the leadership, which is a tax revenue gain. So Amos goes specifically against that in a couple chapters from now. But it's the same principle, though. It's you can do it financially, do it physically. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Oppression is still oppression. So they store up violence, oppression, robbery in the palaces in verse 10. So God's solution, his solution in verse 11, which he hinted on in chapter 2, which was the quaking of the ground underneath you. So verse 11, an adversary around about. Now, the adversary, which I've said multiple times how incorrectly I claimed the adversary being this destruction happened 20 years after Amos prophesied. It's actually 27 years. I was incorrect on the exact date. 27 years later is when the Assyrians surround Samaria. I should correct that in my notes. They surround Samaria for 3 solid years until Samaria finally surrenders after, well, cannibalism and everything else happens inside the city. So Samaria gets destroyed. It takes them 3 years to do it. Assyria just surrounds them until they're wiped away. But that's what happened. That's the type of solution God's going to have. What does that gain God? Does God get anything out of that? Sort of, but not really. Explain a little bit what he gets out of it. What is it that he's specifically trying to stop? He's trying to stop the confusion and the oppression of the people. That's what he's trying to stop. How is God going to choose to stop the confusion and the oppression? War causing oppression upon the oppressor. Right. So God is using the iniquity of the oppressor and visiting right back on the oppressor. You have oppressed, thus you will now be oppressed. Yes.
But doesn't the oppressed suffer through it along with the oppressor?
Yes. They both suffer together. Both suffer together. That's the way, unfortunately, it works. That's the way it works.
Even the righteous.
Yeah, the righteous get damaged, get hurt, get perished, as long with the unrighteous. There is no easy, quick solution. The surgical strike like we get to do in our current modern lifestyle doesn't work that way in God's way of doing things. Yes, Carrie.
It's a really clear way to communicate to an oppressor that they're really on equal footing with the people they're trying to oppress.
That's true. That's true. It does put them on very equal footing. We'll expand this a little bit more on the oppressor-oppressed concept and how this is going to work, because there's other aspects that God's trying to fix. So bring another army in to end the oppression by oppressing those who are the oppressors does one part of it. But that's not all what God's trying to do. Oppression is one aspect. Yes, Sean.
I think it's actually very genius that the creator of heaven and earth does that, because one we know goes to the leadership first, and yes, everyone else pays the price. Hence, everyone else is paying a price. Let's think about who we put in leadership next time.
That's true, too. In particular, in societies where we're allowed to vote for our leaders, although it doesn't make a difference now, they're pretty much all corrupt across the board. But in my opinion, sorry, I should have been careful of that, my personal opinion. When we have a scenario which you could theoretically wipe or remove the oppressor, that's greater or better solution theoretically. But, of course, doesn't always work in practice. So oppression is one of the aspects. That's one of the iniquity items that God's going to try to visit back upon the oppressor. And note the instructions of God given in the Torah are not only upon an individual person. There are many rules and laws, and they're upon the government, how they're supposed to run things. Upon those who are in charge, they're supposed to operate, how their behaviors, how they're supposed to judge between what is right and what is wrong. There are rules and instructions on how to be like God. So when as well as those same instructions of the ordinary individual still apply to those who are in charge. As a result, being in charge, you actually have more instructions to adhere to than you are for those who are not in charge. They're just plain more of them. Not only must you do what everybody else does, but also these other lists on top of that. For example, the high priest, which is in charge of a lot of stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff he has to do. And his whole family has to do. Which only people don't have no care whether he does them or not, because they don't affect them directly. It's indirect, but not direct. So this whole process builds up on itself. So oppression is one aspect of what God's going to strike. But note, what's the other part? In first half of verse 10, it says, they know not to do what is right. So there's oppression, but there's also confusion. That's top half of verse 10. Verse 10, part A, I guess you can call it. It rattles off in the latter half of verse 9. Behold, the great confusions there in Samaria. And the top of verse 10 says, they know not to do what is right. So not only is God going to bring an army to bring oppression back upon those who are oppressing, he has to fix the confusion. How does he fix the confusion? Not knowing what's right? How would an invading army fix that? They can't. An invading army doesn't fix what's right. It doesn't change what is to help explain to you in your own books. Oh, here's the good things to do, here's bad things. Armies don't do that. They take or they kill and they capture. That's what they do. They're really good at it. So how would that fix the confusion? It doesn't. So how's God going to fix the confusion?
Well, if they're attacked by an army, it's kind of like they hit their bottom, if that makes sense. Sometimes you've got to hit your bottom before you can look up.
It is. I'm going to address... Oh, so go ahead, Ellie.
At one instance, they found the books.
They did find books, that's true. But... this specific confusion that which we're going to address next, I'll come back to verse 12 in a minute. I'm going to discuss, we'll go past that to jump to confusion first in verse 14. It discusses which the confusion item shows up. If you've noticed, as the kings of Israel have come and gone, they've gone through many different beliefs of this, that God, this pagan thing, do this, sacrifice that, burn this, do whatever you want to do. Sacrifice this child or that child or so-and-so's child. It makes a difference. They just choose what they want to do. They do it for who? What's the purpose of doing that, all these things that they wind up doing? It's a false god. It's crazy, changing the god around. They're swapping out what God intended versus what God did not intend. I'm going to erase a little bit of space here because I'm out of space. So there's an individual that started a sequence of events. We call him Solomon, which kind of messed everything up. But what expounded beyond it, what took that baton and ran with it, is a man named Jeroboam the First. I'm going to abbreviate. Oops, that's second. Number one. What was Jeroboam the First's main claim to fame? What's the biggest thing he ever did? Yeah, he created two golden calves. The northern Israel, by the way, occurred right under Rehoboam. So Rehoboam actually, as you can call it, the word for cause or started it, because he was Solomon's successor. He was oppressive and just cruel to the people of northern Israel. And they said, forget you, we're done with you. And they said, okay, now we're going to choose Jeroboam. So Jeroboam didn't cause it, Rehoboam caused it, but all by the hand of God, because of what Solomon did. But we won't, that's the separation. But Jeroboam's claim to fame that God repeats over and over and over and over again throughout the book of Kings is the golden calves. And they have a horn, one's in Dan and one's in Bethel. Yeah? Now, by the way, at this point in time in Amos's existence, Dan has been struck so many times, the city of Dan. I don't really know who owns it at this point in time. I don't know if that altar is still around. The town of Dan was struck and taken by the Syrians multiple times, by the Phoenicians a few times, and later on by Assyria. And it happens over and over again. I don't really know who owns the city of Dan when Amos is around. So it's not even mentioned. Amos mentions the altar, the calf of Bethel. They didn't even talk about Dan, because as far as he's concerned, it probably isn't even around anymore. Or at least probably not in the territory. But Jeroboam the First created something. He created confusion. A specific type of confusion. All the way through. He is a source of most of the confusion. The confusion is about God. Who or what is God? Now, in Jeroboam's first solution, he said, the calf, L-F, is God. And actually named him God's name. Well, God explained, no, I am over here. And he maintained his temple in Jerusalem. But from Jeroboam the First onward, and every successive king of northern Israel obeyed and worshipped the calf and the altar and the calf. There is your beginning of the confusion. Not only did that, he also changed all the holy days by at least 1 month. So holy days got shifted. And Shabbat. He changed everything. There is your source of confusion. That's your beginning point. Now I realize confusion expounds from itself. It continues to grow and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But this confusion has to still be addressed. Now God prophesied through a prophet at the time which Jeroboam the First did this, that there will be a man that will come and he will wind up destroying these altars. At the moment that time, I don't recall the prophet's name, the altar that Jeroboam was at, it cracked in two, and Jeroboam accused the man, his arm withered. It's an ugly little mess recorded in the book of Kings. So discuss what the prophecy was already determined. This is what was going to happen. This fixing had to happen. This confusion had to happen. What does an army do when they come through? They plunder. What do they plunder first? Gold. What's a calf made of? Gold! What's the army take? Let's go take the gold. And your holy days, do they matter anymore? No. There's no place to go. There's nothing to go do. There's no worship place. There's no altar to offer anything on. Guess what? Will that fix that too? Your confusion of holy days is now gone. Your calves are gone. Your cities are gone. So the memory of Jeroboam the First's work is gone. That's what an army can do. Will that fix your confusion? It will destroy your confusion, but it will not fill it with non-confusion. It will not fill it with correctness and not fill it with clarity. It will destroy the confusion source, but not create understanding. But that God's objective wasn't to have an army fix their understanding. That's what he sent Amos for, to fix your understanding. That's called the prophets. They explain your understanding, and they wrote it down for you. So you can take it with you into captivity and read it. Oh, really? Oops. Oh, I was supposed to do what? That's how you fix your confusion. You wipe away the source and then replace it with instruction, which is exactly what Amos does and explains with them when his book is written. Of course, also Isaiah and Jeremiah, the rest of them do the same thing. So that's how you fix the confusion. So that's what God's going to wipe away or destroy with this invading army. It's brilliant, actually. Very well done. He seems to do more than, you know, two birds with one stone. He does like a half a dozen. He's quite good at it. Continuing on. Actually, continuing back. I go back to where I jumped to verse 14 to explain the confusion details. I'll have to go back to it again because there's one more aspect of this confusion. Because the transgression is a specific detail. By the way, this worship of the calf and the worship of the altars, that's classified as a transgression, not classified as iniquity. There's a difference. Yes, Ellie.
So the only way to fix confusion is a prophet that goes and tells you and says, this is wrong, this is right.
The only way to fix confusion is to remove the confusion source. The way to fix your understanding is to fill up you with what is right, with understanding afterward the source is gone. It's much like I have a roaring infection. I just pretend I do. Hopefully I don't. Pretend I do. And I go to the doctor, say, I have this horrible infection. Oh, you're going to die from the infection. Terribly sorry, I can't fix the infection. Okay, that's too bad. He ignores it. It doesn't tell me that, by the way, there's a big knife sticking out of your back, which is causing the infection. Now, if I remove the source, the knife, now I can fix the infection. But if he doesn't remove the knife, no matter how many bad advice he gives me, I'm going to die because the knife is still there. So it's the same principle. You have to remove the source. Now we can fill you up with what is right. The prophets will explain that. Now, Amos is explaining ahead of time, hey, this is what's going to happen to you. The following prophets, Hosea does it as well, and then Isaiah fills it in afterward, that, hey, this is what did happen to you. So we're filling you in, explaining this through the whole process. So as your confusion source gets removed, the calves, or the knife, your argument, the calves get removed, you have something to fill it back up again to complete your understanding, to fill in the lack of comprehension, to empty the confusion out, you fill it back up again. And it's like removing demons out of your spirit, same principle. Get the demons out, you have to fill it in with something. You leave it empty, guess what? Confusion goes back in, or demons come back in. You don't want that. You have to refill it back up again, which is what God's doing with the prophets. So the confusion just gets removed by the army. It doesn't get filled in except with the books, which can explain that you can fill it back in correctly. But this is what I think is really interesting, because I like his imagery. In verse 12, I like verse 12. It's kind of gross, but it's interesting. Maybe that's why I like it. I don't know. It says, thus says the Lord, as the shepherd rescueth out of the mouth of the lion two legs or a piece of an ear, so shall the children of Israel that dwell in Samaria escape with a corner of a couch, the leg of a bed. What's he trying to explain there? The vast majority are wiped out. There is virtually an insignificant nothingness left. Because literally, when a shepherd comes back to the owner of the sheep and says, here's the ear from the sheep that's got eaten by the lion, is the owner say, oh yeah, thanks for saving the ear. It's proof, because in Exodus chapter 22, it explains, if the shepherd's in charge of a sheep and the sheep goes missing, the shepherd is responsible for that sheep to the owner, unless the shepherd can produce evidence the sheep was eaten by a lion or some other predator. It doesn't just sheep, it's donkeys, any other kind of animal. That's Exodus 22, verse... something, I forgot the verse. 13. Exodus 22, verse 13 explains that. That's a requirement for a shepherd. So, if the sheep, which is Israel, belong to God, and they get eaten up and destroyed on God's watch... who's God going to bring the little piece of ear to? Well, him to himself. The point is that he's going to see that there's nothing left. He's going to see to it. He's both the shepherd and the owner. He's making sure the lion eats all of it except a piece of ear. That's the most insignificant part, or two legs, whatever's left over. You can't eat them. They're not worth anything. Insignificant part that's left. God will make sure there's an insignificant remnant left over. That's it. And by the way, don't forget, this is the entire house of Israel. That means God's addressing northern tribe, which he explicitly here and explains what's going on in the adversary all around in verse 11. But he addressed northern and southern tribe too. Which means Amos is prophesying hundreds of years in advance, Judah, your turn's next. Now, whether or not they choose to hear it or not, that's their business, but that's what he still explained to both groups. So this insignificant part's left, that's almost left, almost nothing to be of any value. So will those who dwell in Samaria. And after 3 years of starvation, very few people were left alive in Samaria. Because of 3 years surrounding of Assyria, and there's no food, there's little water, you're starving to death slowly, you do suffer. Now, there were still many captured, and still many carried away in the city of Samaria, and the whole countryside was taken long before that. But in Samaria, many did die. Yes.
Because that's where the leadership lived.
Exactly. That's what affects the leadership, because Samaria is the capital, right? And that's who were you trying to teach the lesson to? The leadership, dominantly, they're the ones who are the oppressors. So that we're going to make them address it. I don't know how many of them ate their own children, but still, it's disgusting, but that's how they have to go through it. Let's see here. In verse... Oh, yes. Let's go. Now we're going to move back into deeper, jumping a little deeper into verse 14. It says, for in that day, I shall visit the transgressions of Israel. Now, what did I explain about the transgression he's explicitly referring to? Well, it punished the altars of Bethel, and the horrors of the altar should be cut off and fall to the ground. What's the transgression? The false god is the transgression he's going to be visiting or correcting or fixing. Destruction of that transgression, which is not an iniquity, is a transgression. Now, we think of worshiping other gods as, oh, that's iniquitous, that's evil, that's corrupt. No, it's a transgression. There's a difference. You're not worshiping this other god because you think your real god will hate you for it and you're enjoying it. That would be an iniquitous. You're worshiping this other god in whatever fashion you see fit because you believe what you're doing is good. There's a difference between believe what you're doing is bad and doing it anyway and because of it, or doing what is bad and you don't realize it, but you think you're doing what is right. That's more of a transgression category, all caused, in this case, by Jeroboam the First. This transgression, what I want to bring your attention to, is the horns of the altar should be cut off and fall to the ground. That is a reference. It's a reference to 1 Kings chapter 1 and chapter 2. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 1 and 2 and explain to you a little detailed what that reference... Actually, should I go there first? You know what? I think I'm going to jump to Exodus 21 first. Because Exodus 21 explains something God wants them to understand. And then Kings explains the example, or gives the example of that scenario. So Exodus 21, let's see, verse, well, we'll start in verse 12. One who strikes a man so that he dies, usually put to death, but one who had not lain in ambush and God had caused it to come to his hand, I shall provide you a place which he shall flee. This, of course, example of the place to flee to, the security cities. Verse 14, if a man shall act intentionally against his fellow to murder him with guile, from my altar you shall take him to die. You should ask yourself a question. What is a murderer doing on God's altar? You shall take him from my altar that he may die. Why is he on the altar? An altar is where you kill animals. And it's also in the temple. Take him from my altar. Now, let's go to 1 Kings to explain what exactly he's talking about. This is God's altar. This is not false worship yet. We'll discuss that in a minute as far as how it's applying to Amos and the altar of Bethel as false altars. But in this example of Exodus, this is God's altar. It's the concept I want to point out to you. That was Exodus 21, verse 14. But now we're going to jump to 1 Kings 1, at verse 50 for a story. I like stories. Actually, starting verse 49. Sorry, verse 49 is where actually the story, this story begins. This is 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 49. All of Adonijah's guests were alarmed and rose, and each man went on to his way. Adonijah was afraid of Solomon, who he arose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Solomon was told, saying, "Behold, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon, and behold, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, 'Let King Solomon swear to me this very day he will not execute his servant by the sword.' Solomon said, 'If he will be a loyal man, then a single hair of his head will fall to the ground. But if any evil be found within him, he shall die.' King Solomon sent messengers. They took him down from the altar. He came and prostrated himself before the king of Solomon. And Solomon said to him, 'You may go to your home.'" What was, but Adonijah was his brother, in case I didn't fill you in the story. Adonijah tried to take the kingship before Solomon. And then King David gave Solomon the, publicly, gave him his coronation process, the whole, here's your anointed king, here's this whole process with the high priests. He went up through the whole process, and Adonijah, with all of his men and friends, who thought he'd become the next rightful king, were having a banquet, and they saw, oops, what's going on outside? Oh, look, St. Solomon's now the king. And everybody realized, whoops, now we're all traitors to Solomon. So we're now going to flee and run away. That's what's going on. Adonijah, of course, ran to the altar because he knew he would be executed if he did otherwise. Now, later on, he does get executed, but that's for a different failure. In chapter 2 is a second example of the same scenario. This is 1 Kings chapter 2. Going to verse 28 is when this story starts. Now, the rude news reached Joab, for Joab had sided with Adonijah, although he had not sided with Absalom. Joab fled the temple of the Lord, took hold of the horns of the altar, just like Adonijah, his supposed leader, was going to do. It was told to King Solomon that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord and that he was there next to the altar. So Solomon sent Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, saying, "Go, strike him down." Benaiah then came to the tent of the Lord and said to Joab, "Thus says the king, come out." But he replied, "No, for I shall die here." But Ananias sent back word to the king, saying, "Thus spoke Joab, and thus he answered me." The king then said to him, "Do as he said, strike him down there, and bury him. Eliminate thereby the innocent blood which Joab spilled from me and from my father's house. The Lord will thus return his blood upon his own head, because he struck two men who were more righteous and good than he. He killed them by the sword, and my father David did not know, Abner, son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, son of Yether, commander of the army of Judah. Let their blood return upon the head of Joab and the head of his offspring forever. While for King David and his offspring and his house and his throne, there shall be peace forever from the Lord." So Benaiah, the son of Joab, went up, struck him, killed him, and was buried at his house in the desert. The king appointed Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, in his place over the army, and the king appointed Zadok the Kohen, place of the king of Abathar. So in both instances, we have men who were guilty of different things, one for treachery and one for murder, who ran to an altar for salvation. They ran to the horns of the altar and grabbed a hold of it. That's in accordance to what God instructed. When a man murders, does something evil, take him from my altar after he's been tried or found guilty, take him from my altar and go kill him. Now, Joab, of course, was murdered. He killed him right on the altar. He refused to leave. That's his own business, how he chose to die. The altar, of course, now spilled with human blood, which makes it worthless. Dispose of that altar, too, I'm sure. But that's a side point. The point is that what God is then using that imagery from Exodus and from 1 Kings and bring it all the way up to Amos and his story in Bethel and far as the altar is falling down to the ground. What's God trying to explain? Because he says, "I will punish..." In verse 14 of Amos chapter 3, "I will punish the altars of Bethel, and the horns of the altar shall be cut off and shall fall to the ground." What's he trying to explain to us imagery-wise?
There's no hope.
Just like Joab had no hope. The altar wasn't going to save him. In this case, your safety, your salvation, we use the word safety. Safety is removed. Oh, I did have it written down. I didn't see it. Never done. Ahead of myself. Your safety's been removed. Your source of salvation, which was supposed to be God, But you have thrown your salvation into this Bethel, this pagan idol, whatever it is. It's being taken away. It's being subtracted. So you don't have it. You won't have a safety. So there is no way out. There is no solution. There's no fix for this problem you guys have got yourself into. That's the detail we're trying to explain. It's an imagery deal. But all of them know the story of King David. And all of them would have, the leaders in particular, would have known the story of Joab and Adonijah because, not that they lived it, but they would have known it because that's how they all started too. They all from the same original line. They're familiar with their own history. So they are aware of these rules, these instructions, and when Amos comes along and says, and the example being given, as in visiting the transgressions of Israel back upon him, I will also punish the altars of Bethel and the horns of the altar, means your salvation, your safety net, is gone too. What you put your heart, your belief into, your religious belief, your entrusting in God, there is nothing to trust in. I'm removing that as well, because your trust was corrupt. It was evil, what you were trusting in. And then verse 15, as we conclude Amos chapter 3, I like this chapter, this verse, sorry, for different reasons, other than the bloody one in verse 11, or 12. This is the just interesting one, because I don't know why, I mean, it's just a guy, I don't know, go figure. I will smite the winter house with the summer house, the house of Ahab shall perish, the great houses shall have an end, thus says the Lord. Who has a summer house and a winter house? Rich people. Who has houses of ivory? Kings do. Kings, actually, in particular, Ahab does. It discusses in, what was it? I think it's 1 Kings, the last half chapter of 1 Kings. Anyway, discuss that after Ahab dies, and it says all the great things he did, he built a house of ivory. That was his throne, his personal house. Now, I don't know how big the house was. I hope it was really small, because ivory's, a lot of elephants had to die. He built a house out of ivory. Now, I don't know if he actually, the structural beams, or he just played the interior, I don't really know. Solomon didn't do much different. But he built a house of ivory. Amos is pointing out, when this army comes, and this destruction happens, as Ellie had pointed out, the poor suffer too. The little ones suffer too. The young ones suffer too. Those who are not impressed, not in charge, they suffer too. But who suffers the greater loss? The rich does. In the sheer number and the amount of loss is far greater in that who was rich and wealthy and in command than those who was a pauper. Because a pauper who had nothing still has nothing. They lose much? Not a lot. Hopefully his family's still alive. The wealthy ruler has everything, and now he has nothing, and probably his family dead too. How much did he lose? Everything. That is where Isaiah chapter 10 comes in, the last chapter 10, when it points out when the army comes and destroys those who are in charge, woe to you who make oppressive laws, those who are in charge, where will you hide? Where will you go? You will be amongst the captives. You will be the bottom end like everybody else. You'll be a nobody. And they know who you are, too. They know your names. Everybody knows your name. You can't hide. So in Isaiah, when he explains chapter 10, what's going to happen when an army comes in to these oppressors and oppresses the oppressor, the one who's been oppressed, the pauper, not much really changed for him or her. I assume they lived through it. They're still oppressed, but now they're oppressed in a different land. Their status stayed the same. But those who were in charge, their status changed drastically. They lose immensely. So unlike, for example, the Shemitah year or the year of Jubilee, if it was ever actually done, should have been, but wasn't, those would have fixed these problems over time. Armies fix them very quickly, and they're very efficient at doing so. They take everything, they destroy everything. Those who have spent their efforts in Isaiah chapter 5, as it points out again and again and again, that those who accumulate houses as if they are the only ones set of the land, there is no one else. You accumulate this house, and you have this house, and those over here, you rent them out, let's accumulate more. Those people lose everything. Because God despises that action. To accumulate stuff, to accumulate things to have on your own. I have lots. See all the stuff I have? See all the people who serve me? That is not a positive thing. It's not a good thing. It's a negative thing. have what you need, what God grants you. It's more of an egalitarian society. It's what God intended. More like. I'm not saying it was, it's more like. For there's no one person greater than another person. They're all pretty much the same. Which is how God treats you and I. We're not greater. We're not worse. We're treated pretty much the same because we're all God's children. The same thing. Now, we have different responsibilities, do different tasks. But you're not greater, or I'm not greater than anyone else. Well, in Israeli society, in the northern tribe at this time, that was not the case. The ruling class had everything. And they had their friends who instructed them, also as counselors. We haven't read in chapter 4 yet, but the very first verse in chapter 4 explains it for a couple of verses, all the way through some awful things happen in chapter 4. Pretty awful things. As far as this, the extent of the oppression, and that the leadership obeys the counsel of their friends to oppress people even more. You know, get more stuff out of it. Squeeze them harder. Take more. To accumulate more. To gain more. To have more. Because you're in charge. You can. And since you don't obey any kind of your Jubilee rules, everything has to go back to its original owner, who cares, right? It's all good. So that's what's going on so far in Amos chapter 3. And the whole point of all this, what I want to point out to you, which I already wrote up here once already, is, which, you know, Kathy had, oh, sorry, go ahead.
So, these people that he had to put the army on, they were doing things out of sort of tradition way, because somebody else brought in the cows and then they got accustomed to this worship. That's why it's a transgression, because they didn't understand.
In that part of it, that is a transgression aspect, yes.
Okay.
In Jeroboam, the first portion, that was iniquitous on his part. He knew full well he did it on purpose in order to gain more power for himself in spite of what God said, and knew the instruction of what God told him. And he didn't like those instructions. He wanted this thing more. He did it on purpose in order to make others corrupt and make him more powerful. In his instance, that's iniquity. Subsequent generations say, well, okay, we've always done this. That goes from iniquity, because the intention behind it is quite different, into a transgression class. None of them are good. But the point is, one's iniquity, Jeroboam the first... Yeah, it's awful death. they die bad ways. It's he and his family. Bad things happen to him. That's iniquity. There's a difference there. Versus transgression is a traditional... The example you gave, you pointed out, the point with the subsequent generations, it becomes more of a traditional thing we've always done. It just adds to confusion of what are we supposed to do. People in Judah say there's anything wrong, but I don't understand. They're doing things like this too. It's all strange.